From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Sandra A. Miller, author of Trove, published by Brown Paper Press. Sandra A. Miller's essays and articles have appeared in over 100 publications, including The Christian Science Monitor, Spirituality and Health, Modern Bride, Yankee, Family Fun, and the Boston Globe magazine, for which she is a regular correspondent. One of her essays has been turned into a short film called Wait, directed by Trudy Styler and starring Kerry Washington. Sandra appeared on the Today Show with Ms. Styler to promote the film, which was part of a Glamour magazine project. She also wrote award-winning scripts for 11 Central Ave, a radio comic strip that ran for 3 years in major public radio markets. Sandra has lived and worked across the country and around the world, including New York, Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Luxembourg. She currently teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell, and lives outside of Boston with her husband, Mark Santello, and their two children. When Sandra's not writing, teaching, or traveling the globe, she is probably out searching for treasure, both real and symbolic. Her memoir, Trove, is the story of a woman whose life is upended when she begins an armchair treasure hunt, a search for $10,000 worth of gold coins buried in New York City, of all places, with a man who, as she points out, is not her husband. In this eloquent, hilarious, sharply realized memoir, Sandra A. Miller grapples with the regret and confusion that so often accompanies middle age, and the shame of craving something more when she has so much already. In a very real way, Miller has spent her life hunting for buried treasure. As a child, she trained herself to find things, dropped hair clips, shiny bits of broken glass, discarded lighters. Looking to escape from her volatile parents and often unhappy childhood, Miller found deeper meaning and a good deal of hope in each of these objects. Now an adult and facing the loss of her last living parent, her mother, who is at once cold, difficult, and wildly funny, Miller finds herself, as she so often did as a little child, pressed against a wall of her own longing. Her search for gold, which soon becomes an obsession, forces her to dredge up painful pieces of her past, confront the true source of her sorrow, and finally discover what it is she's been looking for all these years. When I spoke with Sandra, I asked her to talk about fighting the upheaval she felt coming into adulthood, marriage, and motherhood through looking for treasures. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It was a funny time in my life, 2011, and a lot of things were happening. My mother, who had smoked for 70 years, was dying. Mm. She had just had a stroke and a heart attack. My children were moving on to middle school and outgrowing the need for constant mothering. My husband and I were in year 14, and there was some plateauing going on in our marriage. And my writing life had taken a real hit in the recession, in the 2008 recession, and 3 years later, it hadn't even quite rebounded to where it had been before. Okay. And I was feeling this emptiness, kind of an emptiness that I had chased my entire life. But now I was in my 40s, I was hitting midlife. And then my friend David emailed me one day, and he said, "Hey, I know of this chest of gold coins that's buried in New York City. And do you want to come with it? Come with me to go dig it up." And I said, "Yeah, I do, but there might be a few complications." So, you know, really, I couldn't go. I had to take care of my mother. I had my career. I had my family. And I had to go on this treasure hunt because it felt like something I'd been wanting my whole life, like this chance to look for treasure. And not just in the physical world, but in the way that it became a much deeper, more symbolic search for something else that I needed at that time. So what happened is I got called to go on this treasure hunt. I went on this treasure hunt, and it became a very, very compelling part of my life for the next 2 years. But the more I searched for treasure, for this chest of gold coins buried somewhere in New York City soil, and even as I was walking around this defunct airport in Brooklyn, you know, searching for a chest of gold coins, I was really looking for something else. And it became, that became the stronger search. So my whole life I've been a treasure hunter. I've always collected things. I've always found things, little coins, right, and sparkly bits of treasure on the ground. And I put them in my troves, and I still collect them. This is, I started when I was 5 and I'm almost 55. So a lifelong treasure hunter in midlife was called to go on a treasure hunt, and it led to something much deeper. So that's really the story.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why there was this chest of gold hidden in New York City, these armchair treasure hunts.
Yeah, so it's a kind of hobbyist game, and it's a bit of a geek thing where you have to solve these complicated codes and clues to reveal where a treasure is hidden. And usually this treasure is hidden by, sometimes by an eccentric rich person, sometimes by a company looking to do a promotion. Right. Levi Strauss has done one, different companies have done them. And there's a very famous one going on right now that's been going on maybe 10 years. Somebody named Forrest Fenn has hidden $1 million worth of jewels in a chest in the Rocky Mountains. So my treasure hunt was called We Lost Our Gold, and it was set up by some Brooklyn puppeteers as a promotional stunt for their work. So they thought we'll hide 10,000 of these $1 gold Sacagawea coins in a treasure chest. We'll put out 8 videos on YouTube with our puppets, and people can watch these videos and decode the clues and determine where the chest of gold is hidden. So that's where David and I came in.
Okay, great. Now, you also mentioned that this was something that appealed to your very core, not just because of a certain time in your life, but you had always been somebody who loved finding little bits and pieces on the road, you know, little treasures that maybe mm-hmm. wouldn't have meant something to anybody else. So I wonder if you can talk about your earliest memory of getting joy in that way.
Right. So I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut, and it was an interesting town. It was a college town and a factory town. My family was rather dysfunctional. We were a very rigid, middle-class Catholic family. And I felt this need to escape, and my route to escape was through these little things I found. And I would pick something up off the ground, some discarded found thing, and I would imbue it with meaning, mm-hmm. As if it were some kind of code or a clue or even a treasure that was going to lead me somewhere far more wonderful than where I was in my life. So I had a whole, I lived in a complex fantasy world, right, about treasure and finding treasure. And it was my escape, and I took a lot of joy in it. I still do. I mean, I'd practically throw myself in front of a bus if there was a heads-up penny that I was going to miss. So it hasn't stopped. I'm sorry to say, but I felt it at 5, and I feel it now still, this compulsion to pick things up that seem to have some hidden meaning. And I give them my own meaning that would mean nothing to anybody but me.
Now, early in the book, there's a murder that takes place, or there are murders in this bakery, and mm-hmm. you react to it very, you're very frightened, and I in reading it, I felt like this was sort of the curse of creativity that we are, you know, writers are able to sort of see a moment like that as something just, not just something in the news. And also, I think that you sort of knew that bakery, so you were personalizing it too. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how that affected you, and maybe as a creative person, why that maybe affected you more than it might have otherwise.
Yeah, this was 1974, and it was actually the biggest mass shooting in Connecticut until that point.
Oh, wow.
And 6 people were killed in a bakery that was just a mile from my house, and the killers were at large for a month before they were actually caught.
Right.
So I was hypersensitive, and maybe it's the creative gene, and it's the, you know, the positive piece is becoming a creative person and a writer and making a career out of that. The negative piece is that I'm so hypersensitive to everything and having an overactive fantasy life. I imagine that the killers were coming into our house every night. Mm-hmm. And I thought everywhere I went, I just was expecting that one would hop out from behind a tree and kill me too. So I lived with this hyper alert fear, particularly for that month, but impacted me for honestly decades afterwards. Mm. And I used my treasures at that time in a protective way. So they became almost talismanic objects.
Yeah.
And particularly one, which was a lighter, a little red old Bic lighter that I found when the killers were still on the loose. And I remember finding that lighter and thinking, ah, this is some form of protection or safety. And I started a trove at that time. I started collecting all of my little found objects and gathered them. They gave me some sense of safety, and it still feels that way today.
Yeah.
There's some safety in these objects that I find.
You know, it's interesting because you were raised Catholic, and I think that must have also impacted the ability to see talisman in object, right? I mean, because the Catholics, I also was raised Catholic, and I feel like Catholics are very good at that. It's sort of like, you know, finding importance in a statue.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so the Catholics give meaning to everything. Everything is symbolic. It's so ritualistic. And so I think I learned to give symbolic meaning to things from the Catholic Church. As you say, a lot of Catholics, we have this in us, and I just took it to an extreme. So my feeling was, as I would watch this ritual of transubstantiation that happened every week in Mass, where the priest would turn the body and
yes.
blood of Christ into Jesus Christ himself, I would think, well, if that host, that bread and wine can become the body and blood of Jesus Christ, then my little objects can become something too. And that's maybe a bit of a leap to make, but that's just what a young, you know, child's brain does sometimes.
Right.
So I turn these objects into something more than what they were, and I definitely learned that from the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to know from the perspective of writing memoir, and of course, this is something so many memoirists face, is exposing personal information and private truths in public in a memoir. And you, I was pleased to see that you that this book was for Mark, because I thought, oh, okay, they're okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we're fine. We're great.
But how was that? Like, how was that for him or for you or for your children writing about your family in the memoir, and how did people react?
Well, I think it's always awkward, and it's one of the first questions that the memoirist asks, especially when she finds out she's getting published. And it's all great until then, and then that's the what have I done moment of, oh, wait, this is actually going to go public. So I definitely had that moment. And my husband was incredibly supportive about me telling my story in an honest way.
Mm-hmm.
And my children are very proud of me, and they've come to a place where they're okay with this being out in the world. But the real deterrent, I think, was my mother. I couldn't write this fully and honestly until she passed away.
Mm.
So I sort of dabbled in telling this story, and I wrote essays, and I wrote around the story, and then when she passed away 6 years ago, the story just poured out of me, and I did feel a sense of liberation that I could honestly tell this. So I've had a lot of support from my family. My husband always says, you know, you're the interesting one. What am I going to do? Stop you from doing that? So he's been wonderful, fortunately, because it's a very revealing story about our marriage. So but I also think that's important. I think that we need to have these conversations. I want people to talk more honestly about marriage, about midlife. And I want this book to, in some ways, start a conversation, deeper conversations, the things we don't talk about.
Yes.
Because then when we do talk about them, and when we air them, and we actually, you know, we get honest about them, then they don't become problems. in most cases.
And the thing in this book is a lot of what you're looking at is your parents' marriage and how it affected you and your sister. And to see your marriage as next to that is very important because, yes, you have disagreements and, yes, you know, there are times where you feel guilty because you're going on a treasure hunt instead of spending time with your family, but you're so healthy about it. You're talking about it, and your husband is clearly annoyed, but he understands you have to. Anyway, I thought that they worked well against each other because we got to see where you've come from and where you've gone.
Yeah, I think so. And I feel like if we are children with parents who have a challenging marriage, and we can learn from that marriage and do better in our own, then we've gotten somewhere. So I do think that was my path. I witnessed my parents' very, very dysfunctional marriage. Mm-hmm. And nobody who knew them would ever believe that because our pretense was that impressive. But that was the truth. And so I felt like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna do better. And Mark and I are doing great. Mm-hmm. So he just happens to be married to a memoirist who likes to tell stories. So every so often we'll be doing something and he'll pause and he'll say, wait, are you going to write about this? So
yeah.
So there's that. But, you know, he knew what he was getting himself into, or maybe he didn't, but he's okay with it.
There was a scene pretty early in the book, like a quarter of the way in. I wonder if you mind. Do you mind if I read a couple paragraphs?
No, go ahead.
So this, you and your friend David were very convinced you knew where the treasure was. And I'm not going to say what happens, but let me just read this excerpt will say what happens at that point. But here's what I want to read. I didn't say much more, trying to keep belief afloat in that deserted airfield, pretending away my devastation. And honestly, how often is hope like that? How often do we believe we have found the exact right situation, person, career? How often do we think this must be it? Because we have so carefully calculated and planned, we stick a trowel in and get a clink. This is definitely it, we tell ourselves, until all at once it isn't. David and I sat quietly deflated. Dark rain clouds hung low, diminishing our world even further. More than I hated the gradual acceptance of disappointment, I hated that moment in which belief fizzled before your eyes and you had to adjust from a place of high expectation to plain old dirt. I read that last little bit just because I love it so much, but I also loved this concept of, you know, or the comparison, the analogy of the treasure hunt to, honestly, you know, you get an offer for a job that sounds perfect, and when it isn't, you can't believe it, you know?
Oh, your heart breaks so many times. You think, this is it, and you're so sure, you convinced yourself, and then the heartbreak is even worse.
And that was just a beautiful passage about that experience, which is so, I think, applicable in so many different ways. So.
I felt that a lot. That was my experience in this book over and over. Now that you've read it, you know.
Yeah.
So in many situations, and that is a central theme, that we're going to be looking for things and we're going to come up with a clink instead of a chest of gold. And that translates to, you better enjoy the journey. There are a lot of dull clinks. So that was part of my process in this, was realizing, like, oh, all of the wrong paths, all of the problems, all of the empty piles of dirt, they actually meant something. They were indisputably essential to my journey of looking for this treasure. And if I came away having learned something, that was really it.
Right. There's a sort of Wizard of Oz thing happening too, isn't there?
Yeah.
Let's see. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you've already mentioned this, that your family to the outside world looked quite perfect. But I wanted to talk about the disconnect of a well-liked, popular in the world parent who's maybe flawed or unhappy in their parenting relationship. And in particular, you know, I felt like your father was so well liked and seemed almost at certain times to prefer that role in his life. And that is so hard for you as a young person, and forever. So can we just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was one of the great heartbreaks of my childhood. And watching my father be so respected, he had a very, he advanced into a very sort of visible career in state parks in Connecticut. He was an expert gardener, so people were always coming to him with questions. He was a bit of a guru. He was a godfather, like person in our community, in our neighborhood. He was revered by many, many people, very smart, very handsome and strong and imposing. And I just wanted a little bit of that, a little bit of his attention. And it was very, very hard to get, almost impossible for me to get that. He grew up a farm boy with a German dad, with a strict German dad, and he grew up on a big farm, working very hard with his five brothers. And I don't know that he really knew how to have a relationship with a daughter, and we never got to figure it out before he died, which was very unfortunate.
There are some scenes that are just heartbreaking, although beautifully shared, and I think help you know, people who are going through similar, you know, working out their past. I thought you really represented something that could be more universal too for certain people.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely my intention. And for those who do have those parents who look very good and shiny out in public, but then the house, what happens in the house is a completely different story. I want to reach those people, and I hope readers do respond to that piece, because I think there are a lot of us, and a lot of us Catholics who had that experience, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, in the culture where things didn't get discussed as openly now as I think many parents know to talk to their kids about important issues.
Yeah, and there was something very generational about it, too. You and I are about the same age. I think I'm a year older than you are. But, you know, there was something about my parents at that time and sort of what was valued in public and what was spoken about in public and what wasn't shared. And, you know, like, I think that fortunately has changed, too, in ways that will help families, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think every generation does a little bit better than the last. That's the hope.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So our children may do even better.
We can hope. Now, I wonder if any of these, I'll call the chapters essays, because they do have their own titles and their own, you know, stories to tell. Did you publish any of these as standalone pieces or not?
No, I haven't. I've published a lot of essays, but I've used a little bit of this material before, and there's always this central theme of my parents, but I haven't published any of these as standalone essays. Although I cut the book in half, it was twice as long as the published book.
No way.
And
wow.
I I cut about 250 pages, so I've taken several of those stories and worked them into essays, or have sold them as essays, but none of the ones that remain. So
okay, all right, great. Now, this is just a little tiny thing, but this was relevant to the book. But as I read this sentence, it was such good writing advice, I felt like we should talk about it. You wrote, "Getting attached to the incorrect path can force you off track. Sometimes you have to acknowledge the errors of your ways and move on." And I thought, oh my God, that's such good writing advice, because you can go the wrong way and you can get attached to the wrong way because you've got so much invested in it and hundreds of pages, right? Sometimes you have to admit that was a mistake.
Yeah, I've been there only like three times. Well, in a major way, I've started several projects where I thought this was it, this is it, and when I recognized or admitted to myself that it wasn't it, and was able to let go of it, then I got, you know, closer to my path. It was interesting with this book, though. it was a long publishing journey, but I knew all along that I was on the right path. I wasn't exactly sure where the twists and turns were going to be, but I did not give up with this one. I never. There were some times where I felt close, but I refused to give up. And I think sometimes, as sure as you have to acknowledge that it's the wrong path and change your ways, sometimes if you feel in your gut, you have a sense that something about this is going to catch, then be tenacious about it.
Yeah. Now, what I am interested to hear about your publishing journey, and I also wanted to hear about those pages that you had to cut. And I'm wondering what your biggest revision challenges were, and if those came in after you already had an editor, or if that's something that you undertook on your own before you started your finding your way to your press.
Yeah, I when I first wrote this book, it was 500 manuscript pages. Right. And my friend Lisa Carey and I, she had written a book at the same time. And we got together, we exchanged books, we read each other's books, and then we sat down to talk about them and give each other edits. And when it was her turn to do Trove, she took it in front of her, and she took half of the pile off, and she put it to the side, and then she picked up the other half, and she said, "This is your book. It's half of this." So, oh, that was painful. I'm glad we're in public, so I didn't, you know, do anything drastic. But I went away with that information. I thought, yeah, this is a much shorter book than the book that I've written. So I pared it down. I spent probably 2 years paring it down while working with an agent, and it still didn't quite turn into the book that it needed to be. And when I stopped working with the agent, when I knew I had to get off that path, and I left the agent, and I sent it off to a small press, Brown Paper Press. I just had a sense about them. I go on gut instinct a lot, as the book indicates.
Yeah.
And I sent it off to this press, and the editor wrote back, and she said, "Yeah, I love this, and I want about 100 pages less." So now it was at 350, and so I took off another 100 pages and really cut it down to this very sharply focused book, without so many different trajectories as the original version took. So it was very hard to let go of some of those pages, really hard, because some of them were really funny and they were lighter stories. There were stories about my travels, but she made a great point. And I think this is really important for memoirists to realize. You don't have to tell your whole story in this one book. You can have other books. I look at Danny Shapiro, who writes these little flips of memoirs, right? They're about 130, 140 pages, some of them, about marriage, or her more recent one was a little heftier, Inheritance. Right. But I learned that with this book. I wanted to tell everything. I wanted every piece of my life to be in this. And then I realized this is a story with three strands: me and my family, me looking for this treasure, and me and my parents. And when I cut it down to those three strands, this book became a tightly focused book that was I think, even more marketable than what I had before. So I was very grateful for the editor and for all of the advice to cut and cut and cut. It was hard to do, but it was the right decision.
Yeah, you know, I think a really good lesson that you've basically just shared is that, you know, there's two things that you're writing when you're writing memoir. You are writing your story, but you're also writing about life. And you can do that, you know, with lots of different subjects, and you want to leave yourself material to approach it as time goes by, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're writing about your life, but you're also writing about life for everyone who's going to read it and everybody who's going to think about these ideas. Like, writing about your travels seems like a great idea.
Yeah. And you know, my editor made a really interesting point about this. I had some really great stories about my travels and some boyfriends and some love affairs. And she said, "You know, we know right away that you're with Mark, and we know that these particular relationships don't work out. And you spend a lot of time on them in this draft, but we don't get invested because we know they're not your guy. So that the guys that you're going to end up with or the guy you're going to end up with. So that was a really great point. It was easy to get caught up in those parts of the book because they were a really fun romp and they were sort of sexy and spirited, but they didn't belong in there. She was absolutely right. We don't get invested in that part of the story. So sorry, guys, but out you go.
Right. So. Well, and it goes it goes back to this is definitely it. We tell ourselves until all at once it isn't.
You know? Yeah, it all goes back to that, I guess.
It does, yeah. Now, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing, writing your way through the processing of regret or anger or guilt or sadness or you know, family stuff. Writing and versus treasure hunting.
Yeah, I feel like the writing process gave me so many things. It allowed me to grieve my parents. It was very cathartic and painful. I regularly would spend a lot of the time in my office on the floor in tears. And if that sounds a little histrionic and over the top, well, then you haven't tried writing memoir because it can re-stimulate old feelings. And when you have to get very specific about the details of a scene of abuse or of an argument or something that was intensely painful in the moment, and you have to relive it over and over and over again so your reader will see that scene, then it's re-traumatizing. And I had a lot of that when I was writing this. And my sister lives in Munich, and I talked to her regularly, and I would call her a couple times a week, and I would just be sobbing. And she'd say, oh, what are you working on? You know, what's the scene? And so she was very understanding and could really hold my pain around that I had to go through the process. I've written several essays about it for the Brevity blog, the experience of and I think I said one, write like you're giving birth. You know, you're birthing something very painful. So it was cathartic for me. And then to come out the other side and have a book and a story to tell and to share, and having survived the pain, not just in my childhood but in the retelling, was really satisfying. And there's something else which I think about, and it's kind of funny, my obsession with treasure. And the word thesaurus comes from the same root as treasure, thesaurus, and it means, it's Greek for treasure.
Oh.
And so really it's a thesaurus is a trove, a treasure trove of words, of diction. And I think that words are my treasure, and these things I find, my family, the discoveries I made, that's also my treasure. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like, oh, what a beautiful gift that I found. I found my way to words, or I get to have a life where I spend it thinking, you know, I spend it creating with words. So
yes.
It's a gift. It's wonderful. And all of the hard things that happened to me, you know, that's a gift too, because it gave me my stories. They gave me my stories.
Yeah. And it leads us to where we end up. The things that happen to us lead us to where we end up. Hopefully in a good place. Now, you just mentioned your sister living in Munich, and you talk about her in the book, and you describe her, and I have thought this before about my own sister. She is the only person in the world that you didn't have to explain things to, and I felt like that really is so important, particularly when you only have one sibling. I loved the representation of that sibling link in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it feels, and she's the only person now who knows. And I've run these stories by her over and over, and I've said, "Is this right? Do I have this right?" And she said, "You have this right. You know, she can verify that those things happen, because sometimes it seems like this is impossible. No one would believe that this was my family, and yet she knows. I don't have to explain anything to her. She just nods and says, yeah, you're right. Yeah. That's a gift.
One other little quote that I just thought was a wonderful explanation of how you felt when your father died. You said, I miss the past with him I never had, and I miss any future chance to be close to him. And I thought that so well encapsulated your incredible grief at losing him, and especially on the heels of a fairly painful emotional summer. I think it was summer with him before he died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't even know if I have a question there. I just thought that was a good line. It really helped to sort of convey how that grief, what that grief was around.
Yeah, and it's funny about that. You know, I was 20 when he died. I was a junior in college, and it was so hard to lose him right as I was on the brink of adulthood. And yet, I've had 34 years to grieve him, to write about him, to forgive him, to make sense of that, of our very broken relationship, and to really love him in a way that I didn't when he was alive. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing about, I think, and that goes back to the writing. I think a lot of that happened in the writing because I was able to understand him by thinking of him as a character sometimes, my father, but when he becomes a character in my stories, I can see all of the different dimensions, the way he was hurt. He was a World War II veteran. Horrible things happened to him. He saw terrible things. He was stationed in Japan. And I know he got hurt in ways that I couldn't understand when I was 20, but as I grew into an adult, I came to understand and love him very much.
Yeah. Sandra, I wanted to just change gears a little bit here and ask you if you have read anybody else's work recently that you might recommend to listeners.
You know, I recently read a friend's book, actually. It's Body Leaping Backward. It's Memoir of a Delinquent Girlhood by Maureen Stanton. And it's a beautiful book. She grew up in Walpole, Massachusetts, in the shadows of a prison in a big Irish Catholic family in the 70s. And for those of us who survived the 70s and all of the weirdness that went on, it's a really, really interesting and very intimate look at a family growing up in the 70s and how children were very disconnected from their parents and the threats that were happening in the world. So it tells a bigger story about the 70s, but it's also a very intimate portrait of a family. And I've been trying to read more books just by put out by independent presses, and I came across a beautiful book called The Skin Bird by Chelsea Biondolillo, and it's a collection of poetic essays that kind of works on you like a meditation. It's about birds, but of course it's not about birds, it's about so much more. So that's another beautiful little slip of a book that I recently found.
Oh, that's great. I have not heard of either of those, so that's exciting when I hear of new things. And now you're talking about indie presses, and that makes me realize I wanted to just talk to you. So Brown Paper Press is a small press, but you have a pretty great book tour organized, it looks like. And I'm just curious if you've done that all on your own or if you have the support of your press or how that works.
Yeah, I have... My publisher is fantastic, and it is a small press. But she has a big vision about publicity and marketing. And when she signed me, she said, "You know, we're going to be a team on this, on the marketing of this book." And I said, "Absolutely. I feel like I've been waiting to do this for 4 years, so I was ready." And I have a big community around me. I teach at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. I have a lot of friends who are in the arts. So I just thought, all right, I've seen them do it. I've watched my writer friends go before, and I thought I'm going to do that too. So I've set up most of the book tours, but Wendy has done a lot of outreach in other areas. So we're trying to, you know, build the platform.
That's great. Are you working on anything new? Are you writing anything right now? Or maybe not right now?
I'm writing a lot of essays. I have a lot of essays coming out in the fall. I have one in Writer's Digest. I have one in McSweeney's today. It's not really an essay. It was a raunchy little humor piece.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and so as I'm very, very distracted by all of the marketing and promotion around this book,
sure.
It's very hard to focus. But I do have this idea because a lot of people have said, have seen something in the book Trove, in my memoir, that they recognize it's maybe something that they want to try. How do I go looking for treasure? So I'm actually writing a book. It's in the works. It's called Dig Here. And it has a self-help component to it.
Oh, fun.
Where it actually helps people think about how do we find treasure in our lives? All right, here we go. I know how to do this, and I'll take you on. You know, I'll show you how to go on your own journey. So,
oh, very cool.
So I'm having some fun with that. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great. Now let's see. You mentioned earlier in our conversation something about when you'd find these little trinkets, and particularly when you were, you know, going through a very painful or difficult time, you might imbue them with meaning. And we did talk about that. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about how well that fed your story. And I feel like that in prose and poetry can be just so incredibly rich, you know, the objects and places, objects helping to present a story and being imbued with meaning. And so, for example, you know, you write about your mother's bedside table drawer, I think, and that becomes something that has more meaning as the book goes on. And then you have your father's trunk under the attic eaves. I mean, these were real places, real objects that were part of the story, but they become imbued with more meaning in the book. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about that from the craft perspective.
Oh, yeah. From the craft perspective, objects give us such opportunities for exploration, I think. If you have an object that's working with a central theme of your book, I think it's really worth it to spend a lot of time turning that object over and over and looking inside and out and exploring it with all of your senses, both literally and in writing, because a lot can be revealed through these objects, and you can use them. They can serve as touchstones in your story.
Mm-hmm.
They can intensify the themes of your story. So in my case, my theme of treasure, and every time one of these objects is explored in the story, it underscores that theme, or it heightens that theme, or it reminds the reader that we're on a treasure hunt.
Yes.
Throughout this book. And so I feel like don't miss the opportunity to really use those objects and make it clear to the reader what they are and what they mean to you, and give the reader a chance to see them in a deep way.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would say a really good example, which we haven't talked about, but you have this wonderful scene, which I think is probably a true story from your childhood, where you looked out a window at a certain moment when you were feeling certain feelings, and you saw, I think it was a crow that had like a sparkly something in its beak, and then it flew away. And that became such an important moment for you in so many different ways, but that crow and that sparkly something, they took on a lot more meaning in the book. And I loved that.
Yeah. Yeah. The crow follows me through the book, and the crow is with me now, still.
Yeah.
Spiritually anyway. But that was my earliest and strongest childhood memory. And I honestly think it happened before I was 5, but I don't know if anybody would believe me. I don't remember the exact year. It feels closer to 3 or 4. I was very little when I saw this bird land in my front yard, and it felt like the bird took a piece of my heart. And that is the prologue. That's the story that really launches my treasure hunt that continues to this day.
Yeah.
Was that crow that seemed to fly away with a piece of my heart. And I was going to spend the rest of my life looking for that piece of my heart. And that was my priority, to get my heart back. And that's what the story is. It's about me looking for all of these objects, for the crow, but really I'm just looking for my heart.
Yeah. I mean, it was such an incredible book for the story you wanted to tell and the way you were able to tell it, thanks to the treasure hunt, which was a real thing for you. So
Yeah. Thank you.
I just have a couple last questions. I always like to finish up by asking for advice for writers. My listeners are mostly writers. And the advice in your case, and sometimes I've asked people this question, but this is something we didn't talk a lot about, but you're very funny. The book has a lot of humor in it. And, you know, I know everybody always says that humor is the backside of tragedy, that they are, you know, on other sides of each other. But I think it must be hard to present, you know, a sad memory with humor in it, and yet you do it so well and so consistently. So I wondered if you can give advice for approaching that, if it's something people want to do, or if you think it's just innate and can't be approached. I don't know. What do you think?
I do think it can be approached, and I have to say I really appreciate that, because a lot of what got cut were some very funny scenes, and so I was afraid this version didn't have enough humor in it. So I really appreciate you recognizing the humor, however dark it is sometimes. You know, I think humor can be learned, and I think humor is about not being afraid and putting yourself out there, not being afraid to say the inappropriate thing, the untoward thing, especially if you say it on the page, because you can always pull back, right? Sure. And it's just letting loose a little bit. There's a very funny side to death, and there's a very funny side to all tragedies, and our family, with my husband and my two children, people always joke, wow, you guys are really sarcastic. And we are, but we just tease each other all the time. We're merciless. Even in the darkest situations, we're always cracking jokes. And if you can get comfortable with doing that and not judging yourself for finding the humor in something, and let yourself play around with that, explore that a little bit, put it on the page, see what it feels like, see how people respond to it. It feels a little risky at first, but, you know, it can be reworked in the editing process. Sure. So I think humor is just, you know, taking a risk.
Right. And I think some of the funny stuff is actually presenting what people might not expect or even approve of. So, like, I loved that you and your son would go for these cursing walks.
Yes. And then my son, who still loves to curse.
And you had this funny moment where you're like, maybe this was a bad idea.
Yeah, we'd go, and we'd look at the moon, we'd walk hand in hand, he was little, and I'd let him say all the swear words he wanted to say, and I thought, oh yeah, he'll get this out now, and then he won't need to curse, because he'll be fine with cursing. And then, of course, you know, it all blew up in my face, and, you know, nobody loves to curse more than my son, so, trained by his mother.
I want to mention again, the name of the book is Trove, A Woman's Search for Truth and Buried Treasure by Sandra A. Miller, published by Brown Paper Press. Sandra, thank you so much for speaking to me, and I so enjoyed your book.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author, Sandra A. Miller. You can learn more about her work at sandraamiller.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Sandra A. Miller. Read the following lines from a poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, What If You Slept? And then use these lines as your prompt for the week. What if you slept? And what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven and there plucked a strange and beautiful flower? And what if when you awoke you had that flower in your hand? Ah, what then? In other words, what if we pulled our dreams into the world and made them a reality? What would you want to bring into the world, your physical reality, from your dreams? And what would you do then? When Sandra shared this with a group of writers recently, the results were rich and the experience of writing emotional. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. That's also the site where you can find out about my book giveaway. You'll see a tab with that hashtag. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it with your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.
song, but it bears repeating now.
Looking for something I'll never find. Digging for gold in my